This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with an Airbus captain who is a former military pilot and a guy you've heard on another aviation podcast. In the news, a charter flight runs out of fuel and crashes, the Bombardier CS-300 launch customer takes delivery of the first aircraft, an airline pilot suffers a heart attack, managing massive amounts of aviation data, charging for overhead bins, an autopilot system for general aviation, and a big pay raise for Delta pilots. Also, remembering December 7th, 1941, and the 75th anniversary of that day. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 430 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is first Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Max West, how are you?
What? I get to be first?
Yeah.
I'm kidding. I'm great. How are you, Max? And hello, co-hosts and listeners around the world. It's just an ugly gray day here in California, which is kind of fun. It gets kind of boring having six straight months of sunshine. So we're looking forward to a little bit of winter here.
Oh, dear. I'm in gray Rhode Island right now, and I could use some sunshine. But speaking of sunshine, also with us is Mr. Sunshine, Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. And Max, and it was very interesting that you talk about the temperature. And this morning I get on a call with a customer of mine and I talk about it being freezing here. And he says, what, is it in the 50s? And I said, no, it's only 62. You guys, very, very cold for Southern California.
Rough life. Also with us from somewhere in the middle is Rob Mark. He's the senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I'm not going to say much because after the way you guys intimidated me before we started recording about how Nick's going to stay up until, I don't know, 5 o'clock in the morning to do this show, I should stay up too, but I'm not because I'm only here for about an hour tonight, guys. Sorry about that. I've got a really early flight, and you know me, I need all the beauty sleep I can get.
That's what we hear, yes. And also, our final co-host this episode, our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hello. Greetings from gray Philly, since we're talking about the weather, but I'm looking forward to talking quick reaction alerts tonight, so I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, good. Well, our guest this episode is Captain Nick Anderson. Now, Captain Nick has always wanted to be an airline pilot, possibly because both his parents served in World War II. His mother was in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force as a wireless telegraph operator who at one time intercepted German-coded Enigma transmissions to pass along for decoding. How interesting is that? His father was an Australian flying the Sunderland flying boat in the Royal Australian Air Force submarine hunting in defense of the Atlantic convoys. And after the war, Captain Nick's father became a civil airline pilot, starting in the DC-3 and finishing on the Boeing 747. But as for Nick, he joined the Air Cadets at age 13, went solo in a glider at 17, gained a flying scholarship at 18, and earned his private pilot's license. He worked in a flying school, but ended up joining the Royal Air Force at age 21 as the only way to get paid to fly. He trained in the Chipmunk, the Jet Provost, the Fallen Gnat, and the Hawker Hunter. And he then streamed to fighters and flew the F-4 Phantom. Now, during a 19-year career, Captain Nick moved from the Phantom to the Hawk T-1 trainer as an A-1 FastJet qualified flying instructor, then back to the Phantom to become a qualified weapons instructor. He moved to Australia on an exchange tour flying the FA-18 and finally back to the UK to fly the Panavia F-3 Tornado air defense variant. Finally, Captain Nick obtained an air transport pilot's license and left the military to join an airline. He flew the Airbus A340-300, the 340-600, and also the Airbus A330-300, doing round-the-world long and ultra-long-haul flights. Now, if Captain Nick sounds like a familiar name to you, that's, of course, because his most recent hobby is to podcast with Captain Jeff, Dr. Steph, and Miami Rick on the Airline Pilot Guy show. There he adds a little historic interest with his Plane Tales segment. So, Captain Nick, it's a great pleasure to have you here with us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, Max. It's an absolute delight to be on your show. I've looked through past and listened to many past episodes, and you have a great standard of guests come along and share the show with you. So it's a real honor for me, and thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
Oh, yeah, you notice he mentions the standard of the guests, but he doesn't mention the standard of the
co-hosts.
Smart move.
That's taken as read, of course.
Oh, I see. Oh.
All right. Well, why don't we get started with the aviation news, because we've got actually quite a lot this week to talk about. So are you guys all ready?
Yeah.
Ready from the West.
We have a number of articles that you'll find in the show notes covering our first story. This is about the Lamia Charter Flight 2933 from Santa Cruz de la Sierra in Bolivia to Medellin in Colombia. It crashed on November 28, killing 71 of the 68 passengers and 9 crew. According to a leaked recording, the plane was low on fuel. We'll talk about that a bit. The Colombian Civil Aviation Authority has apparently confirmed that the Avro RJ85 did not have the fuel reserves mandated by ICAO for commercial flights. Maybe we could start out just sort of reviewing for everybody just what those fuel reserve mandates are. Captain Nick, you're probably pretty familiar with those requirements.
Well, yes. The normal absolute minimum is 30 minutes, and that's kind of your final minutes of emergency fuel. You should always be on the ground, even if you've diverted and having not been able to land at your destination. You should get to your diversion with 30 minutes of flying time. So this guy should have arrived at his destination with hopefully enough fuel to divert. Now, that's not always a requirement. It depends on the regulations. It is possible to burn that diversion fuel, for example, in the hold if you commit to an airfield. But the regulations when you decide to get rid of that fuel are usually quite tight. You need to have good weather. You need to have two runways available just in case an aircraft blocks one of the runways. And it's not done lightly. It's something the commander, the captain, makes a decision, and he has to be pretty certain that it's safe to get rid of that diversion fuel. So this bloke should have pitched up with enough fuel to complete the flight. There's a little bit of holding fuel if he's sensible, a fuel to get to a diversional airfield, and then an additional 30 minutes of flying. So it doesn't sound like he had really obeyed the regulations there.
Has anybody heard what the weather was like at Medellin when this whole thing was going on? I hadn't, so I just wondered.
All I recall is that it was dark, because there was some discussion about had they stopped at Medellin, they could have refueled, but unfortunately they don't have lights of that aircraft. This flight was delayed a few hours, and so that no longer was an option.
There were some other flights sort of in the area as well. Lamia flight 2933 was south of Medellin and descending from its cruise altitude at the time. But there was another plane, according to reports, a Viva Colombia flight that was diverted to Medellin due to a cockpit alarm. Now, reportedly, they didn't declare an emergency, but they were given priority for landing. And then in addition, there was an Avianca flight, AV 9771, going into Medellin at the same time. They were in a holding pattern after the Viva Colombia flight, and then the La Mia flight was number three for the approach, but they never declared an emergency. Maybe if they had, the situation would have turned out a little differently.
Yeah, I found it very hard to understand why the captain was allowing his fuel to get so low and without making a bit of a fuss. And I'm wondering perhaps he didn't want to admit that he had not had enough fuel reserves on board. But heaven's sake, it's much more important to get your aircraft and passengers safely on the ground and take a rap on the knuckles than it is to risk doing what happened to him. I just can't understand it, why he didn't insist that he go ahead of the other aircraft, since none of them had actually declared an emergency that I'm aware of. Even the aircraft that apparently had a fuel leak didn't declare an emergency, or perhaps I've misread.
No, that's what they're saying. In fact, the airline has, Viva Colombia has, according to reports, come out and said that they specifically did not declare an emergency. But, Rob, you were going to say something?
Well, what I was going to say is that, you know, certainly in that part of the world, we don't have reliable information sources. Not that I'm... you know me, I'm always interested in speculation when I can, but it's got to be based on facts. And right now, boy, we sure don't have much at all. Except one thing that really bothers me quite a bit is that the captain on this flight was also a part owner in the business. And
right.
So there was some significant economic nudging going on, I'm sure, to get that airplane there. But I think it said they maybe did a couple of turns in the hold or something before they went in. But I can't imagine leaving altitude. I mean, if you're short on fuel, for God's sake, why come down low where you're going to suck a lot of gas? If you're short on fuel, at least stay up high where you're going to burn a whole lot less. And then, but see, as Nick said, there are things here that just don't make any sense at this point.
Hey, Rob, and one of the things that you talked about not making sense or just really questioning the accuracy of the information, in the Fusion.net story that'll be in the show notes, they talk about an airport official warning the captain before they took off that the plane didn't have enough fuel. So I asked Captain Nick, if an airport official were to tell you that they didn't think you had enough fuel, wouldn't you stop and double check your figures and make sure that you actually did have enough to make it to your destination?
Well, yeah, if any sensible captain listens to all inputs, finally, of course, the decision is up to them. And the final decision, regardless of what the company or anyone might say, is always the captain's. But if someone said, are you sure about your fuel load? I would go, well, okay, let me just double check that. Because I don't care whether it's my first officer, my second officer, one of the cabin crew, I haven't said. If someone imagines or thinks they have information that affects the safety of the flight, any responsible captain is going to take it on board. I am a little concerned that it wasn't the fact that he could have taken more fuel. It was the fact that because he didn't land at the en route refueling stop, he had basically reached the limit of endurance of the aircraft. He couldn't actually physically have taken enough fuel to safely conduct this flight because the aircraft didn't have the range to do the entire flight without stopping. Now, I'm only taking that from the basic aircraft range figures. So I don't know, perhaps he had a strong tailwind, which might have made it safe and comfortable for him to carry, to go with a full fuel load and still get there. But I reckon he just wasn't in a position to take more fuel.
And I misspoke a moment ago when I said no lights at Medellin. I was thinking that that was the airport that they could have refueled at. Of course, that was actually the destination. What I do see in one story is that the Colombian Air Safety Secretary said that the flight was supposed to have gone from Santa Cruz de la Sierra to Cobija Airport in Bolivia for refueling. before going on to Medellin, but apparently the departure from Santa Cruz was delayed, and it was the Cobija airport that doesn't operate at night, which might be why they didn't stop there for refueling. So it sounds like the plan was originally to stop for fuel, but that since it was delayed, it was now dark, they couldn't do that.
Hmm. Yeah, but think about what we're saying here, because a number of us are pilots that, oh, well, our refueling stop is closed, so... Ah, well, never mind. Well, we'll make it.
Just keep going, right?
Yeah. You know, I mean...
it's always worked out before when we've done that, right?
Hour out of the destination. I mean, they had to know that things were going to be tight. And so I think that this is going to be interesting to see if we can, when they, you know, get the CBR going, what in the Sam Hill they were talking about in there. I mean... I know. From what I read, the first officer was fairly new, but still, I don't know. I mean, it's just hard for me to imagine sitting in the other seat, looking at the range of the flight and the range of the airplane, and not looking over at the captain saying, "Okay, what's your plan on this one?" You know. But I don't know. There's probably something we're missing here.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we all learn about the five hazardous attitudes, one of which is invulnerability. It won't happen to me. And I certainly remember early in my flying career thinking, oh, yeah, all this stuff happens to other people. And after a while, you kind of smarten up and realize, no, I'm not special. Any of these things can happen to me as well. And it does seem like there's a certain amount of denial that was going on here, some belief that, you know, somehow he was special and it was all going to work out, which obviously it didn't.
Well, hopefully we'll have a good, impartial, and thorough investigation on this one and really learn what happened and learn from it. Hopefully learn from it so that we don't see that repeat. But I guess we'll have to wait some time for that.
Well, luckily, Max, it's not that common an event, so I don't know if there's any real lessons that the majority of us would take away from it. We'll just look at it very sadly, at a guy that just pressed his luck. And hopefully there aren't too many of us out there that are willing to do that. I mean, the last time I can think of a situation a bit like this was that poor Mexican 707 trying to get into JFK a really filthy night. And because the first officer was the only bloke that spoke English, and he was not a very forceful character, and really got pushed around by JFK controllers and wasn't able to get across to them that they were running out of fuel, they you know, did a very similar thing. They ran out of fuel on finals.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's move on to a story that's maybe a little brighter than that. This is from BalticCourse.com. World's first Bombardier CS-300 aircraft arrives in Riga. Now, Air Baltic, the national airline of Latvia, is the first airline to take delivery of the CS-300. They're the launch customer, and they intend to begin commercial operations in December, December 14th, I think. This is great to see the first CS-300 out there, the first one delivered. The orders for the CS-300, I think, are about 235, which is quite a bit more than the smaller CS-100, which orders amount to about 123. Three of those have been delivered. So we have four now C-series aircraft delivered, which is great. Glad to hear that.
Yeah, looking forward to flying it. Just guess I need to get over to Latvia to get that done.
At least right now.
Yeah.
Max, what do you think? 235 aircraft. Do you think that's really enough for Bombardier and their Canadian backers, the government, to make their money back on the huge investment they've had to make?
Nope.
It's a start, but yeah, I think they probably need more. In one of the articles that we'll have in the show notes, I recall that Bombardier was asked by someone, when will they break even? And I think the response was 2020, I think, maybe plus or minus a year. But that seems pretty early as far as break even point on this sort of thing goes.
Optimistic is probably the word we're struggling for here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's a lot of water yet to go under the bridge before that happens. I mean, I remember when they when they thought the A380 was going to be profitable. I forgot when, but of course, and that still hasn't happened and probably never will.
Yeah, I was going to say every year of its existence, they've said that, I believe.
Well, and every year there's going to be more competition. I mean, the Mitsubishi jet's going to be here, and just seems like it's going to be tougher and tougher to get the orders they need to pay it off.
There's an interesting article in Airways Magazine on this. It's titled, On Board the Delivery Flight of the First CS-300 to Air Baltic. So they were actually on the flight. And there's some nice, interesting comments in that article, observations from the flight that are, I mean, generally pretty complimentary. This particular aircraft is configured with 145 seats using the Zodiac Slim Plus. And that has a 30-inch seat pitch, which is nice. They're 18.5 inches wide, except for the middle seat. Those are 19 inches wide. So you get an extra half inch in the middle seat. Of course, it's single aisle, 2+3 seating. Those three CS-100s that are flying, that's Swiss. They're actually leased from Lufthansa, the launch operator for the CS-100. So again, four of them out there, more to come. I think the second Air Baltic CS-300, I think it's set by the end of the year. We'll see the second one delivered.
An extra half inch in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah, I took my two fingers, put them apart, and looked at what a half inch would be.
And I'm but it's better than being a half inch less. Yeah, so you know I'd be happy.
I would never notice it. Oh, funny.
All right. Next item comes from the BBC. Airline pilot suffers heart attack at Glasgow Airport. This was a KLM flight. The captain was they were about to leave for Amsterdam, and he suffered a heart attack as the plane was taxiing on the runway. Of course, I mean, obviously very, very unfortunate. I guess you can say better than the later or at other points in the flight, particularly because the crew and a passenger apparently resuscitated the pilot, and he was taken to the hospital, listed in stable condition. So at least, you know, that's good news for this pilot.
Yeah, I expect that's probably the end of his career. I don't know how old he was. Did anyone manage to find that out?
No.
No, and that's actually what I was going to ask you, Captain Nick, over, you know, age of retirement and people having heart attacks and things like that. It just seems like as you get older, the chance of it happening increases. And just what, you know, is it a good thing having mandatory retirement at 65? Or do you think that it should be all physical based and, you know, passing your medical exams and all that?
Well, the trouble is you can pitch up for a medical exam and pass it, and the next day you can have a heart attack. The examination is, you know, one moment in time, and it doesn't really predict what's going to happen to you in the future. The change in retirement age, or the change in the maximum age you can hold a Class 1 medical, really was done on statistics, and it was based on the number of incapacitations that had occurred and the extended life expectancy, and they looked at it pretty closely, and I think they decided that they could safely fly pilots up to 70. But in order to give a decent safety buffer, they would knock it back 5 years and make it 65. And that's assuming you've got, you know, a trouble-free Class 1 medical. So there are a few restrictions that we have to abide. I don't know if these are worldwide or just apply to my medical, but if I'm flying with an elderly first officer, which is a pretty rare thing, we're not allowed to have two pilots on the flight deck who are over 60. So once you get to 60, you have to double the frequency of your medicals. So it goes from annual to 6 months. And like I say, you must have someone younger than 60 beside you on the flight deck, just in case you do decide to pop your clogs on a flight. But quite honestly, the frequency of this happening, it is a pretty rare event. So, this is pretty unusual. It's quite often that people die of heart attacks, but to actually happen in that short period when you're actually flying the airplane compared with all the rest of the time you spend kicking around, that's relatively rare.
Are those restrictions that you just mentioned, Nick, about the age of two pilots, is that specific to your airline, or are these global requirements?
Well, that's, I believe, an EASA. So it wouldn't be a global. I mean, the FAA would have a different, might have a different attitude, and I don't know what their regulations require. But certainly, that is a European license.
Hmm. So, Rob, I was going to say, Rob, how are you still flying? What you have your medical every what, 6 weeks?
What?
Oh dear.
Is this a multiple choice question?
What's good nowadays is that if you're going to have a heart attack, having it on an aircraft is a pretty safe place to have it because you've got a defibrillator right on hand and a whole bunch of crew who are usually very well trained on using it. At least that depends, of course, on the airline. It's not a legal requirement in Europe, whereas I believe it is in the States. But certainly in Acme Red, my airline, we have it. And, you know, you can have that defib on you pretty damn quick if you've got a problem. Hmm.
Unless, of course, the lead flight attendant is perhaps a lady that you just broke up with, and it was a very ugly breakup, and she notices that you're turning a little gray, and she goes,
"Sweet revenge.
Maybe he's just taking a little nap."
Yeah. Anyway. Well, there you go. There's a moral to be found there somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't tick off the flight attendants.
Yep.
All right.
That's always true.
I think so.
Well, we learned that last week with our guest.
Yes, we did. All right. Next item comes from Business Wire. GE Aviation launches configuration data exchange to reduce maintenance costs. Now, I mean, this is a press release, but just to quote from it a little bit, the configuration data exchange connects aviation companies and allows for the digital exchange of key operations, maintenance, and configuration data. In basic terms, this can be thought of as a data pipeline that will allow for two-way asset data flow between airlines, MROs, lessors, OEMs, and parts brokers, and it will be agnostic to the various IT systems of record. So we talked about large amounts of data that either are currently generated or could be generated in flight, and the different uses for that, not the least of which is just identifying the location of the airplane. But there's also other flight data, engine data, and so forth that could be used for maintenance purposes and so forth. According to this press release, the annual spend on manually managing data within airlines is, get this, $4 billion. I was kind of shocked to hear that. So this
and that number is probably accurate within, what, 50%? I mean, how do you come up with a number like that for something like that?
Well, GE Aviation is teaming up with a company called Capgemini. And these two teams, they're working together on, customer engagements, but also Capgemini is going to provide implementation services. And in fact, in the most recent episode of the PaxX podcast, number 41, Mary Kirby and I talk with Michael Dennis, who is affiliated with Capgemini. So we'll put a link to that podcast episode in the show notes if you really want to dive into the detail. In our conversation, Michael explains why, as more aircraft data is moved across any channel on ground or in flight, operators need to know how to process the data and make it meaningful. So, I mean, this is kind of like big data comes to aviation, and you know, how do we handle that? I think it's a big issue, and overlaying it, we have this GADSS. Mandated by ICAO, the Global Aeronautical Distress and Safety System, which is something that looks to establish aircraft tracking time intervals of 15 minutes. And so there's, you know, yet more data that we're talking about transmitting from aircraft in flight.
But they have to sign up for it.
It's not a requirement, right?
No, well, I don't believe it
should
is.
Be.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that's really neat about some of the data that's coming across, and I've seen this at, you know, at Gulfstream, at Embraer on the business aviation side, is this great tool that onboard aircraft, while they're airborne, that says, oh, my goodness, do you realize there's a number two fuel pump on the left engine that is about ready to die? And even if it doesn't fail before the aircraft lands, it sends a message to the next place along the road and says, you know what? You guys might want to meet the airplane with an extra fuel pump. If not, get one pretty quick. And, you know, trying to stay ahead of issues that can ground an airplane if the crew has to wait until the thing lands to chat with maintenance. I mean, that's just one example of some of the cool stuff they can do if the data is managed correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an article in the Runway Girl Network about this. Title is Why BizAv is also a key market for GE's new data exchange. The chief digital officer for GE Aviation, Jim Daly, says this is something that would really benefit a fractional ownership group, he says, because most fractional ownership operators fly many different business jet types in many different configurations. So being able to, you know, capture, track and, you know, use this kind of data, like you suggest, Rob, could have some big payoffs. All right. Another story we have. This is from WKBW. That's the ABC affiliate in Buffalo, New York. It says United Airlines will charge extra fee for use of overhead bins.
Yay.
Yeah.
What?
This is called basic economy. United Airlines has this new ticket option, basic economy. And it does allow you to bring one, I guess, and only one small item on board, but it's got to fit underneath the seat in front of you. Check bags incur a fee. What do you guys think? Brilliant marketing plan on United's part?
A brilliant stupidity plan? Is that what you said?
So
I don't see this working. I don't see and there's so many things wrong with this policy. I think we could dedicate a show to it to let me go off on that. But no, I think it's a bad idea.
Well, there's a part of me pragmatically that says, oh, wow. Well, maybe if they started charging people to put things in the overhead bins, they might be a little more cognizant of what they bring aboard. I mean, I've watched people bring bags that I thought had their kids inside of them, and then they tried to put the things in the overhead bin. Or
farm animals, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Or some person who is not very tall bring something on board and then look at somebody in the aisle and go, can you help me get that up there? I can't reach it. You know, and the flight attendants are usually good enough in some of those cases to do that. But again, it does take an awful long time to board an airplane when people bring these monster bags aboard. But I doubt very seriously United has that in mind. I'm sure it's seen as simply a way to make more money.
Yeah, the question I have is initially, do these tickets cost less than regular economy?
That's the way they're selling it to the public, but I think it's simply a way to have that be their base starting price,
yeah,
and then the regular economy tickets will cost more. And the bad part is, being a business traveler, you use a business booking tool like Concur. It doesn't know that. My company only pays for the least expensive ticket. So the other thing that United has failed to really mention at this point is if a person has status with them and they buy a basic economy fare, do they still get to carry a bag on board and still board in their zone and still get a pre-assigned seat? And if the answer is no to that, I see business travelers just running from United because why deal with it?
Yeah, I think the answer is no, but that's just what I gleaned from what I've read on this.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is no one wants to stick their very expensive computers and cameras and other bits and bobs in the hold.
Right.
For a start, it might not end up the same destination that they're heading for, and that could be a nightmare. But just the concern about having it thieved or smashed on the way over.
You're right.
Yeah, and I just don't want to have to pay more to fly for my company to have my bag arrive the same time I do.
Yeah.
Well, then get inside the damn bag, Brian. Come on.
Simple solution.
Okay, I could do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure this is.
They don't just play a little slot machine on the overhead. So you put in a coin or swipe your credit card, and then the bin opens, and you can put your bag in.
Yeah. Mr. O'Leary would love that idea.
Yeah, I'm sure he's thought of it.
Now, the other thing is there's no pre-assigned seats, so now you're a family of five traveling together, and you get nothing but middle seats scattered throughout the cabin.
Right.
Sure, I see that as being a great thing as well.
Yeah.
I mean, he says sarcastically.
Okay, can we move on? Can we stop complaining about tubes with wings?
No, David, we cannot do that. So, but we can move on. We can talk about an item in the from the EAA. This is new autopilot STC project. Follows EAA's lead, and the STC group is leading a project to certify the Trio Pro Pilot autopilot system in Cessna 172 and 182 aircraft. They say this is a two-axis system with full navigational capabilities, envelope protection, return to level, and 180-degree turn features for uninterrupted IMC encounters. Okay, somebody translate that for the rest of us.
Well, this is actually a growing interest area on small aircraft because, of course, the Cirrus some years back when they debuted the Garmin panel on the aircraft had a little blue button, which was the "Oh my God, I'm out of control" button, and you could press it, and it would turn the autopilot on if it wasn't already engaged and level the wings. And so it was kind of neat. In fact, when I was I'll have to tell you guys about this probably next week, but I was over in Germany last week flying a Remos, which is a light sport airplane, and the avionics in there, same thing. It's got an autopilot, it's got a wing leveler, all kinds of goodies that if you get in trouble, hit this button. And the airplane's back level again. And part of it, whether the diehards in aviation say, "Oh, well, come on, these people ought to be able to fly the airplane." Well, you're right. But in the meantime, we'd also like to try to find a way to reduce loss of control accidents. And sort of part of that is something like this. But obviously, too, part of it is going to be much better training than what we're doing. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that they say that it's there really for unintended IMC encounters, which to me means that some bloke's going to go along and go, "Well, actually, if I could use it for unintended IMC, I'll just go through this cloud I'll intentionally use it." So
absolutely.
I can see guys taking the dangerous option and trusting this bit of kit to take them through cloud that they're not qualified to go through and wouldn't be able to fly the aircraft without this piece of kit on board.
Well, and look back at the days 10 years ago when they started introducing glass airplanes, electronics. Part of the motivation was that it was going to increase safety. And what they found out is that people were crashing perfectly nice Cirruses and glass 182s just like they were before. And but that turned out to be part of the problem was that people were saying, "Well, you know what, this thing is pretty capable. I could just put it on autopilot and it'll do a great job and I'll just go this way and I don't have to worry about it." Except it turned out not to work that way.
Our last story, this is another good news story, I guess. Delta pilots get 30% raise by 2019 in new contract. Well, 82% of the pilots voting ratified a new four-year contract, retroactive to the beginning of 2016. Merry Christmas. Now, Delta's 13,000 pilots are going to get an immediate 18% pay raise, and cumulatively 30% by January 1st, 2019. Now, they say that in this article that a Boeing 737 captain with, say, 12 years experience would enjoy $284 per hour in 2019 compared to $218 in 2015. So a big bump. I imagine the pilots are pretty happy about this.
I reckon they are. But to be fair, I have a feeling that the Delta pilots gave up a considerable chunk of their wages in past years to help the company through some hard times. And I don't know whether this is just trying to get them back on an even keel or whether it's a genuine increase over what they would have been earning at the current time.
Yeah, I think that's a real important part, and the story doesn't mention that at all. And I think most of the major airlines in the U.S. had some kind of givebacks or freezes or something in the last 10 to 15 years. And so while, you know, many listeners may say, oh, my gosh, what a ridiculous amount of money. Well, that could be if you took it at face value. But as Nick said, I think we'd probably need to see what they were doing, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I think the other thing is when you look at the hourly rate, it's from when they release the parking brake until they set it again, right? You know, the block in, block out time. All right, I guess I said that backwards, a block out to block in time. So there's an awful lot of work that goes into flying an aircraft before and after that they're not getting paid for. So
The hourly rate
delays on the ground. It's really a crazy number and a crazy way to calculate things. So I don't know, Captain Nick. Do you like? Do you get paid that way, and/or do you like that as far as compensation?
No, I don't get paid that way, and I'm very grateful I don't get paid that way. It just seems a weird way to operate. It's a bit of a hangover, I think, from past times. No, I get paid an annual salary. And it is irrelevant how many hours I fly. I'm contracted to fly 750 hours a year. But if for whatever reason I'm unable to fly that, I get my annual salary regardless. And we see that as a good way because the company roster us and they keep a track of how many hours and they can follow us up the graph as we progress through the year and make sure that they're going to get the most work they can out of us. But on the good side of it, we don't get concerned if we have a bit of illness and we don't think we're safe to fly. We don't feel obliged to pitch up and try and fly with a bad cold. So just to try and get those hours in to get our pay, because knowing that if we don't fly, we won't get paid. Now, I much prefer, I think a slightly more mature system is to give a guy a salary and then work him up to his contracted hours.
Yes, yes. What happens if you fly over the contracted hours, or does that not happen?
Oh, it does. You can earn overtime. So okay. I think you can actually, the way our company works, we can opt to fly under the contracted hours. So we can fly effectively a part-time job. Or we can work an overtime job. So you contract yourself to fly 110 or 115% of the hours if you wish. And that's up to the individual. And the company are very good about accommodating them.
Rob, have you ever heard about a retroactive pay increase? I found that one really bizarre. And especially to go back to the beginning of 2016.
Depends when the negotiations began. Quite often it's you say, right, well, we're due to a pay increase now, but we haven't finished negotiating. So when we do, we want it to start from when we started the negotiations. That's a hard word to say.
Yeah, actually, it's not that unusual, Brian. I mean, different groups are often, when the contracts are ratified, paid backwards like that to cover various and sundry issues. But again, it's all airline by airline, to be honest.
Again, we're speaking with Captain Nick. Captain Nick, thanks again for coming on the show. It's great to be speaking with you rather than just listening to you on the Airline Pilot Guy.
Well, I'm trying to be more polite than I am on the APG show, so I hope I'm. And also, I have to say, rather than drinking great quantities of IPA, this evening, in honor of this very sophisticated show, I've got a rather nice Scotch whiskey here.
Oh, perfect.
So, please, fire away.
Do I get this correctly that, I mean, you're essentially an Airbus guy, at least in terms of commercial aviation? You haven't flown Boeing at all, is that correct?
No, I haven't, other than in the simulator. When I joined my company, we all had to do a skills test. So the last aircraft that I had flown was a Tornado, and the next aircraft I flew, albeit in the simulator, was a 747. And I pulled that beastie around the skies, did all the various bits and bobs they wanted me to do. It didn't seem to be a big problem. Nice airplane. And, of course, my father flew it. So, to be honest, and please don't tell Miami Rick this, when I joined the company and I heard they were putting me onto the Airbus, I did actually phone the flight operations director, and a nice gentleman called Nightingale, and said, "Captain Nightingale, it's one of your new first officers here, Nick Anderson. Is there, I don't suppose there's any chance of getting onto a 747 course, is there? Because, you know, I'd really quite like to fly it." And he just, there was a long pause, and he just said, "Don't push your luck, Mr. Anderson," and put the phone down. So that's how I ended up on Airbus.
And so you've been flying the A340 and the A330. Are you flying just A330s now?
Hold it. I'm correcting him. He has flown Boeing.
Is that right? Well, okay, David. What's the Boeing that Captain Nick has flown?
You're not going to try and tell me the Hornets are Boeing. Come on.
I was about to say the Phantom's a Boeing, too, if I believe all the publicity.
Don't believe the publicity. I'm afraid sticking a sticker on an airplane doesn't make it a Boeing.
Good. I like this guy. Go on, Max. We can continue now.
All right. Thanks, David. So which Airbus are you flying now?
Still on the 340s, albeit only the 340-600 series, which is the big one, the big 359-ton version. And I think still the only longer ever. Oh, I think Miami Rick's 747-800 might be a trifle longer. I'm not sure. Anyway, pretty long, pretty damn long airplane. That and the A330-300. We used to have some 340-300s, but those have already gone, and our 340-600s are due to disappear in the next couple of years. Mm.
But you're not flying them out to California any longer, though, are you?
No, we're not. It's very sad. They've decided that the 787, with its economical long-range capability, is a better aircraft to put onto those long routes. And they, the commercial division say that flying the 600, the four-engine 600, because of its high fuel consumption, it's better to keep to the shorter routes where that high fuel consumption penalty, you don't bear it for quite so long. So we're sticking on New York's, and we're doing quite a few Lagos flights with it, so that sort of thing.
Hmm. Well, which route do you enjoy the most?
Well, I used to enjoy LA a great deal, San Fran, Hong Kong, and I don't get to go to any of those now that the 787 has pitched up, which is a bit sad. But I guess when the A350 arrives, which we are getting in a couple of years, those might well pick up some of those routes, but it'll be a bit late in my career to get onto the 350. I'll probably be right up against retirement then.
So when I ask which routes you enjoy the most, your answer is based on the destination, I guess, right? Not the flight itself.
Well, yeah, that, exactly. Yes, yeah. There are some destinations though I look at and think, well, it'll be great when I get there, like Joburg. But actually, flying down through deepest Africa has its problems. Another route you might say is a nice easy route would be, say, a Dubai. Because a lot of it's European air traffic, which is very nice and easy. And some routes just are a bit more tiresome. We have to be, you concentrate a bit more because there are a lot more decisions, strategic decisions to consider during the flight. The old flights over Siberia when we went to Tokyo were always a bit of a captain's headache, if you were doing your job properly, that is, because you've always got to think what airfields you might have to go to, and say you depressurized, how you're going to keep all the passengers alive at 10,000 feet without pressurization for a relatively long period in Arctic conditions. And then you might get to a pretty remote airfield where the conditions on the ground might be very wintry and there might be no hotels and, you know, just all those problems about trying to deal with a small town of people on board an airplane and then suddenly dumping it on a very remote part of the world.
The situation is not that you get to sit back, relax, and look out the window.
Well, you do, but my mind is always ticking over. Yeah. Like, you know, I wonder what Archangel is like this time of year. And if I take all these South Africans into Lisbon, for example, are they going to be able to get off the airplane? Have they got visas? Will the local police or immigration let them off the airplane? All those various things that weigh on you. And you, I spend a lot of time reading the latest information about where it's good to take an aircraft. Going over Africa, you have to have a reasonable awareness of the political situations in a lot of countries, because you might well want to overfly one airfield to go to one that's just a little further away because you know the government is a bit more stable and you're likely to get your aircraft in and out with less problem.
Interesting. On these long-haul flights, how much personal time do you get at the destination?
Oh, on the shorter flights, say in New York, we usually get 24 hours. On the longer flights, say over to San Fran or L.A., 48 hours. So, and that's a very pleasant break.
Sure, enough time to enjoy the local sights and food.
Well, on my particular airline, we've always had a very good standard of living. We go to some great destinations, and we don't fly quite as hard as some airlines. And we have never been enumerated quite as well as some of the other long-haul airlines. And that's been our compensation. We've always considered the fact that we don't work quite as hard and we get more time off down route than a lot of airlines is our compensation for perhaps not being paid top dollar.
You know, with your background and family history and all, I just really can't help but imagine that you are really destined to fly. You've been able to do that both in the military context and in the commercial context. When you think back on your military days and look at your current commercial job, what do you think about those two different types of aviation? Do you see those as completely separate times in your life, or is there something common that runs through them both?
No, they're very much separate times, Max. The military flying was such a different style of flying. My life was run in a completely different way. A lot of the time I didn't have children, just I was married very early on, but my wife and I just enjoyed living day for day, and the flying was without parallel. At the time, I didn't realize it, of course. It's only looking back at it now that I realize what a wonderful time I was having. I mean, I had a good time, but don't get me wrong. But the flying, I had nothing to compare it with. Everyone did that kind of flying. Everyone around me did that, enjoyed that kind of lifestyle. So it didn't seem unusual. But looking back at it now, those Air Force days and the kind of things we got up to really did set me up so well for living a life of contentment. Now that I'm just droning a big long tube through the air, I look back on those days and think to myself, oh, if I'd joined the airlines as I initially tried to do as a 20-year-old and I got in, what a dreadful time I would have had by now. I would have been bored stupid, and I would have missed that fantastic opportunity to fly those wonderful fighters.
Wow. Of all those jets, is there something that – one of them that stands out is sort of offering the most excitement or the most interest for you?
Well, my heart lies with the Phantom, really, because when I first climbed into it, it's such a big monster of an aeroplane, and it was so powerful and so evil-looking. And at the time, the F-15 was just starting to arrive on the scene, and the Next Generation was there, but we were still pretty much where we went. Leaders of the pack. It was a fantastic aeroplane, very exciting, and quite a technically difficult aircraft to handle. So it was a challenging aeroplane. The later generation of fighters I flew, the F-18 and the Tornado, they were a lot more all singing, all dancing, and you could play all sorts of tricks in them, but they didn't have quite the same character as the Phantom. And for me, that'll be the fighter I'll always consider to be my era of flying.
David, have you got any questions from the military segment of Captain Nick's life?
Well, I talked about QRAs, and I was curious if you actually got to do any interceptions with QRAs, or otherwise known as quick reaction alerts.
Oh, most certainly, yes. For the uninitiated, the United Kingdom maintained two sets of fighters, one to the north and one to the south, that were fully armed and at readiness every day of the year. And we policed, and people think we used to go and sort of fight the Russians or the Soviet aircraft away, but no, that wasn't true. We went out and intercepted and escorted Soviet aircraft that were flying through our area of interest. We didn't own the air. You can only usually own the airspace within a few miles of your coastline. So we were working several hundred miles out. But yes, regularly got launched and intercepted Russian bears, badgers, bison, coots, various military airplanes, doing sometimes straightforward transits around the North Cape, down past Iceland, out into the Atlantic, or perhaps they were going to monitor a NATO fleet exercise if they were maritime strike bomber like Bear Deltas or Bear Foxtrots. And we would escort them while they were doing that, which usually required a fair amount of organization, because we only had relatively limited endurance when you're several hundred miles north. So we often had an air-to-air refueling tanker with us, trailing us around, say, 5 or 10 miles behind us. And we'd have to liaise with him and keep ourselves topped up so we had the fuel to complete the mission. And we used to sit beside these aircraft sometimes for hours and hours whilst they went about their duties. We were taking pictures of them, they were taking pictures of us, and we were all sort of waving the flag, as it were, and defending our little right to be there. We were making sure that they knew that they couldn't come into NATO airspace without expecting to be intercepted, and they were saying, well, we're going to come in here anyway, as was their right. It was a fascinating time and an excellent job, and particularly when you were doing night intercepts on these things. It was always quite taxing in those early days without a lot of night vision equipment. We didn't have any initially, and then it was very crude what we had. And the pilots certainly didn't have any. The navigators were, because it was so big and clumsy, the navigators used to use it just to try and identify the aircraft type and any markings and things. So it was an interesting time. Not a fighting war, thank God. But certainly interesting flying.
Yeah, it's amazing how much things change over time.
Oh, yes, and then they don't, because the Russians have been penetrating the airspace recently again and again, and now it's a new generation of pilot in their Typhoons that are going out and doing the same job.
So what would you rather have, a F4 FG1 or a Finn F3 to do your QRA?
Well, I think I'd rather have the Phantom, quite honestly, than the Tornado to do the QRA. The Tornado was it was underpowered as a fighter, and we used to drop some of our missile load to hold QRA because we couldn't get up to the same height as the bombers without using a lot of reheat, and that consumed the fuel too fast. So it was, you know, so in military power, we struggle a bit. So, no, the Phantom never had any of those problems. It was a very meaty beast.
Captain Nick, we wanted to talk to you about plane tails. And I know that many of our listeners, Airplane Geeks listeners, also listen to Airline Pilot Guy, but not all of them do. So maybe tell us a little bit about, or tell them a little bit about what plane tails is all about.
Well, I'm not quite sure how it came about, really, but I started putting in a little extra a bit of my own feedback into the APG show, and it started off as just that, and I said to Jeff, look, I'm thinking about perhaps making this into a slightly more regular thing, and I might, you know, start it off as my own podcast. And Jeff said, oh, well, why not make it part of the APG? We know we'll make it a regular part. So that's
because APG isn't long enough already, right?
Exactly right.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, you started it because you were bored. Nothing was going on during the show, right? So, yeah, you had to fill some time.
Well, exactly right. But I did feel a bit embarrassed by, you know, doing a 10 or 15 minute extra segment, as if, you know, because it means that perhaps we don't cover all the feedback we'd like to. So, you know, that's not ideal. But I get a real kick out of it because there are lots of little nuggets there in aviation history that a lot of people don't know about. Now, I don't know about them all either, but I certainly know a few. And I'm learning more all the time. And it's great to do a little historic piece that reminds people of what went on in the older days and the things that people have done that need reliving so that we can appreciate them again.
Maybe you could just give us a couple of examples of some of the topics you've covered recently.
The last one was, that was the poor chap that was sucked out of the front windshield of a BAC 111 when the front windshield popped out because it had been incorrectly maintained, and he was sucked out of the front, and the cabin crew member grabbed hold of his belt and stopped him from going completely out, and he spent the next 20 minutes being beaten half to death, flapping up and down on the side of the fuselage, a 350 knot gale, minus 17 degrees. Everyone thought he was dead. And when they landed, the first officer did a quite remarkable job, considering that everything on the flight deck had just disappeared out through the same hole. He had no maps or approach charts or anything. He got the aircraft onto a runway, and they put this chap into a stretcher, and he probably came round, and they all thought he'd died, and that's just one of the stories. But the one I sort of think back to perhaps more is the old Captain Ogg, who ditched this aircraft, four engine prop, between Hawaii and LA or San Fran. He lost an engine, then lost a second engine, and he had a Coast Guard cutter out there in the middle of the ocean, and he flew around it for a long time, and then when the sun came up, he ditched this aircraft beside it, and everyone on board survived. And his only real disappointment was killing about 1,000 canaries, I think, that were in the hold. He couldn't get them out safely.
Yeah, we had talked about that on the show when the movie Sully came out. We talked about successful water landings, and in the show notes, I think we put the URL to the YouTube video because the people on the Coast Guard cutter captured it on film.
Yes, they did. In fact, it was probably quite well known in the States because the Life magazine did a full-blown article on it. And at the time, he would have been as famous as Captain Sully is now because of the marvelous job he did. Yeah, and it's not easy. I mean, he ditched his aircraft in the open ocean, for heaven's sake. Sully did a fantastic job, but he did a river landing. The water's a lot flatter. I mean, when you're coming into an open ocean, that's that water can be hard and lumpy. So I think he did a great job.
Yeah, one of the Plane Tales series that I really love was the interviews that you did with your dad, and I really hope that you have the opportunity to do some more of those. They were fantastic.
Well, yeah, thank you very much indeed. It was fascinating because we covered things that we'd never actually, as son and father, discussed before. And using the tape recorder and the microphone as a sort of a prop, it was a lovely way to get him to talk about some of the things that he would never have brought up in ordinary conversation. So I was learning almost as much as everyone else when Dad told me a bit about his flying career. And he's still going strong, but he lives in Australia, so he's a long way for me to get out to go and see him easily, although I do as often as I can. But next time I'm out there, I certainly will have another go and see if I can get some more stories out of him. Thanks very much, Brian.
Yeah. Do you have, Captain Nick, do you have some topics in the list for the future?
Well, I sort of work hand to mouth a little. I'm rarely more than one plane tale in the bag, as it were, or in the can. The one I have for the next Alan Panagai show is called High Flight. And if anyone knows about John Gillespie McGee Jr. And High Flight, then you might enjoy that. And it's rather poignant because this is the time of year when he actually wrote the poem a little earlier, but he died on the 11th of December, which is kind of coming up. And it was all around, and I tell a little story around America coming into the war, which, of course, Pearl Harbor is, I think it's 7th December, is that right? It's the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack. And America came into the war on the 11th of December as well. At least that's when Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States. So it's all around this time. So it seems a perfect opportunity to tell that little story.
I put in the show notes a suggestion for the B-17 story that just got beaten its nose off. And I think, although it was covered in this article, I think having you tell the story or do some research and find out some more about it would be a really interesting story.
That's the 398th history article. I think I've taken a look at that. That looks great. That's a terrifying amount of damage done at the front of that aircraft. I think it's remarkable that the guy managed to land it safely. So, yes, that looks like it'll be a fantastic story. I'll certainly take that under advisement, sir. Thank you very much.
All right, good. Well, you can catch Captain Nick on the Airline Pilot Guy podcast, which is airlinepilotguy.com. So which of those guys is your favorite?
Well, on the crew?
Yeah.
Well, of course, it's Miami Rick. He's definitely my favorite because without him, I have no one to argue with. No, seriously, Captain Jeff is just wonderful. He's a great raconteur. He's a lovely speaker. He's a very organized guy, and he's got a heart of gold.
Yes, he's a very nice guy.
Absolutely. You put all those together, and it's hardly surprising people love listening to him. And he's the one that's built the show, and I'm the most junior of the crew to join. So I have to take my hat off to him. And, of course, I couldn't leave Dr. Steph out because not only is she accomplished very pretty, and she does these amazing sports. I mean, she throws herself out of airplanes. She runs marathons. She's just a remarkable human being. I'm just a delight to chat to her. It's a real privilege to meet her. And what's more, she could probably drink all five of us under the table, no trouble at all.
And a good job with chicken nuggets, too.
Yes, she even does a good job with those. So it's probably reasonable for her to run all those marathons to get rid of all the junk food, because I know she's a bit of a junk food fanatic.
All right, good. So are you able to stick with us, Nick, or is it too early in the morning for you?
No. I've probably got another half an hour before I turn into a pumpkin.
All right. Well, Rob has, in fact, turned into a pumpkin and dropped off so he can get to sleep for his early wake up. So we'll look forward to him spending the full episode with us next week. Meantime, we have our history segment from David Vanderhoof, the airplane of the week. So, David, do you want to take it away?
Thanks, Max. The day we release this will be the 75th anniversary of the attack of the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. That day, the U.S. lost 2,403 Americans with 1,178 wounded. Up until 9/11, it was the largest loss of life on U.S. soil. I have been asked to talk more about people and less about machines, so here are a few slices of life from that day. I asked what the most significant aircraft of the Pearl Harbor battle was. I think most people would be surprised by my answer. The most significant aircraft was the Nakajima B-5N2 Kate. The Type 97 carrier attack bomber first flew in January of 1937. 2397 of the Imperial calendar, thus the 97 carrier attack bomber. The B-5N1 fought in the Sino-Japanese War. The Dash 1 had several weaknesses, mostly armor and protection. Instead of up-armoring the aircraft, the 2 was given a better engine. The Sakai Model 11 14-cylinder was also used in the A6M fighters, otherwise known as Zeros. The aircraft was also more streamlined. The Kate was the finest torpedo bomber of its day when the attack on Pearl Harbor occurred. The Kate could carry a 1,764-pound bomb load at 235 miles an hour. On December 7th, the Kate carried Commander Misho Fushida. Fushida was commander of the IJN Akagi attack wing. At 0740 local time, it was Fushida who fired a green flare to start the attack. It was also Fushida who would tend the code words to this day that would symbolize that attack. Tora, Tora, Tora. Tora in Japanese means tiger. However, on this day, the code word acronym was Tosugi Rakige, or Tora, or lightning attack. It meant the attack was a complete surprise. Besides that, why is the Kate the most significant aircraft of the attack? 5 B-5N2s from Kaga and from Hiro attacked the Pennsylvania-class battleship the USS Arizona. Flying at about 9,000 feet, the Kates dropped 797-kilogram bombs. These were actually modified 16-inch armor-piercing artillery shells. The Kaga's aircraft attacked from stern to bow, while the Hiro's attacked across the bow. At 0806, one of the local shells penetrated the deck in front of the number 2 turret and exploded the black powder magazine there. The explosion ripped the Arizona and took 1,177 officers and crew. The Kate also carried the Type 91-dash torpedo. The 91 had an additional wooden fins that would break off upon impact on the water. This caused the torpedo to run shallow in the shallow 40-foot deep harbor. The torpedo sank the USS Oklahoma, West Virginia, California, and the Nevada, which got underway and then was beached on purpose. Only the Oklahoma and Arizona were complete losses, as well as the USS Utah, a training battleship. Nevada, California, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and Maryland would return to service and fight. A second wave of Kates, 54, attacked the airfields. They flew level attacks. They would drop 60-kilogram and 250-kilogram warheads on the various airfields. Japan had 2 major failures with the attack. First, it was decided not to send in a third wave. If they had the Kates and Vals do the third wave, they would have attacked the shipyards and dry docks and the fuel farms. Since they didn't, the U.S. Navy was quickly able to repair the fleet and get them to sea. The 3 U.S. carriers also weren't in port. Enterprise was delayed by bad weather, Saratoga was in San Diego, and Lexington was on her way back from Midway Island. Fushida was the last Kate over Pearl and returned to Akagi after the first and second waves completed their missions. Fushida's Kate had 21 flak holes and his control wires were barely functional. The U.S. Army Air Corps made it easy for the Kates. To protect the aircraft from what was perceived as a sabotage attack by sympathizers in the Hawaiian Islands, the aircraft were parked in very tight rows, wingtip to wingtip. At Wheeler Field, a second lieutenant, Philip Rasmussen, woke to the sound of bombs. Rasmussen threw on his boots and his .45 pistol and ran out of the field wearing his pajamas. Rasmussen was able to get into one of the poorly parked P-36Cs and taxi it to a revetment for fuel and bullets. With three other P-36s, they took to the skies in a lull in the bombardment. The four aircraft flew north where they engaged 11 fighters. Rasmussen was able to shoot down one Kate. He was attacked by two A-6M2 Zeros. The Zeros took their toll, and the pajama-clad second lieutenant took refuge in a cloud bank and made his back to Wheeler Field. Rasmussen landed the P-36 with severed hydraulics, a shattered canopy, landed with no brakes, rudder, or tailwheel. The P-36 had more than 500 bullet holes in it. The lieutenant colonel retired from the United States Air Force in 1965 with a Silver Star for bravery for his actions on December 7th. He would add an oak leaf cluster for another mission over Japan. He would also shoot down another aircraft in 1943. The very first aircraft you see in the World War II portion of the National Museum of the United States Air Force is a vignette of a P-36 being prepped for flight with Rasmussen's PJ clad at the controls. Now, if you want to know more about some other formal wear worn by the United States Army Air Corps, I suggest you look up the stories of Second Lieutenant Kenneth M. Taylor and Second Lieutenant George Walsh, and I will have links to those in the show notes. So with that, on this Remembrance Day for the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Oh, thanks, David. I see in a Washington Post article just published today as we record this that the Japanese Prime Minister is planning to visit Pearl Harbor with Barack Obama at the end of this month, December, and that would make him the first leader of Japan to go and visit the site of the attack. I think that's kind of a significant step.
It's the reverse of President Obama going to Hiroshima earlier this year.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's very great. That's a great story, David. And I love the details about that guy's aircraft, the amount of damage. But tell me, wasn't part of the Japanese success also due to the technology of their torpedoes? They had some pretty sophisticated equipment there, didn't they?
The Americans never got torpedoes right in World War II. Actually, the Mark 91 torpedo. And ready for this off the top of my head. The idea of using wooden fins to keep the torpedo running shallow, because the Pearl Harbor is very shallow and muddy, was learned by the British in the Battle of Tarantino when they attacked the Italian fleet. The British implemented the wooden boxes on their fairly swordfish torpedo bombers in the Battle of Tarantino.
Oh, well, I never.
You always learn something from David.
There you go. And the fusing was very sophisticated on those torpedoes, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. They had everything right.
All right, well, let's move on. And Max Trescott and Max West have some news for us, doing some flying and something interesting.
Oh, I had a lot of fun yesterday. I was kind of reversing roles and playing a student in the aircraft. I hadn't flown the Diamond DA-42 in a number of years, so I was going back and getting recurrent in what turned out to be a week-old, brand-new Diamond DA-42 NG. And I spent almost 2 hours in it and just had a great time. The new airplanes have 165 horsepower turbo diesel engines from Austro engines versus the 135 horsepower engines that were in the original DA-42s. That's what makes this an NG versus the non-NG aircraft. And this also has the new Garmin autopilot, which is far superior to the original KAP-140 that shipped with the early DA-42s. This plane was also Rafiki capable. So flight into known icing, which is pretty rare for aircraft in the GA fleet, especially those which you can rent in the flying clubs. And lastly, it had the air conditioning. But anyway, it's just an awesome plane. I love it. It's very nicely well-balanced controls. So it's just a joy to fly. You almost feel like you're part of the airplane. It's just you're kind of one with the airplane. It's a very nice, stable platform as well. And it was just great fun. So anyway, it was fun to be the student again and had a great time.
Was it the autopilot you said is improved, the Garmin autopilot?
It is. That's the GFC 700, which came out in 2007, first in the Cessnas, and then started moving into other manufacturers' G1000 aircraft. So it has some nice modes that are not available in traditional GA autopilots, such as the ability to climb at a specified airspeed as opposed to at a specified number of feet per minute. And that has a huge advantage in that the aircraft will never pull itself up into a stall when the autopilot's engaged. So it's very nice autopilot.
Very good.
Now, could I just ask a general question about autopilots in GA aircraft?
Sure.
I mean, we've talked a lot about in the aviation world, the airline world, about the lack of handling skills because obviously we fly using autopilots the great majority of the time. Now, considering the average GA pilot doesn't get that many hours, if they own their airplane, I guess that might be a bit different. But isn't there a sort of a conflict, and aren't GA pilots likely to end up with the same sort of problem that airline pilots are accused of not handling their aircraft enough if they combine perhaps the frequency of their flying with the use of autopilots?
Sure. I mean, you could certainly say that that's an issue on both sides. You know, do they lack manual flying skills if they're using the autopilots? I think the reverse is equally true. I think there are a lot of GA pilots who have very poor understanding of the autopilots, and I think that's because a lot of flight instructors don't necessarily teach the autopilot, or kind of go by the old saw that real pilots don't use autopilots, which I think is just silly. If you look at the fleet as a whole, we got, about 200,000 airplanes here in the U.S. Most of the autopilots in the planes that are more than, say, 20 years old, pretty poor. And even, in those older airplanes, I would say probably at most about 20% of them have autopilots. So it's really only the airplanes that have been built in the last 15, 20 years where there's a, high preponderance of autopilots. And, yeah, it's a challenge for, getting people both to learn the autopilot well and also maintain their manual flying skills.
Yeah.
All right, great. And Brian, we're nearing the end of the calendar year here. How are the mileage? How are the miles racking up?
They've definitely racked up this year. And to go along with the Max Trescott joke, I've flown over 200,000 miles, and boy, are my arms tired. So with United, I'm in the middle of two back-to-back trips to DC when I finish this second trip. So I'll end the year with 191,865 miles on United, a few other miles on American and Delta, but my United miles, so close to 200,000, but not quite there. But still total overall miles, over 200,000 miles I've flown this year.
Wow. So how does next year look? Are you going to break that record, or is this a record for you?
No, I believe this is a record for me. I've never really paid attention until probably the last 10 years, and I've been around 150,000 miles every year. I hope to fly less. It's just not nearly as fun any longer with United imposing things like economy basic, and I'm just not doing the international travel that I used to do. I'd kind of like to get back into that, but my job is preventing me from doing so. So I'd really like to cut back. So we'll see.
All right.
And, that translates probably into at least 500 hours. So I think you should just go up front and start logging the time. you'd be logging more time than most pilots.
Yeah.
All right, we have some, this is kind of exciting. You recall Brian Terwilliger. We talked with him in episode 427, and he's provided two copies of his movie, Living in the Age of Airplanes, One in Blu-ray, the other's a DVD. Both are signed copies. And Brian, are we going to do something to try to give these away?
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should have listeners send in just an email to Airplane Geeks with the subject of living in the age of airplanes, and we'll do a random drawing. So just send in an email, specify what format you want, first choice, second choice, I guess, just in case, or I don't know, maybe we'll sort them out. Yeah, I guess we should probably sort out who wants Blu-ray, who wants DVD, and we'll randomly choose a winner.
All right, and how long should we give people? A week, you think, or?
Oh, no, I'm probably 3-4 weeks behind listening to people. So all the podcasts I have. No, I'd say 3 weeks.
All right, let's say by the end of the year.
Yeah, the end of the year.
By December 31st, send us that email, subject living in the age of airplanes. Tell us which of the two discs you would prefer, Blu-ray or the DVD, and we'll randomly pick one. We'll do that the first episode of the new year, I guess. Right, Brian?
Yeah, that sounds good. And I think that it's great that Brian took the time to sign them as well. So
yeah,
these are
nice.
our director autographed copies.
Great. Okay. Another announcement, the Commemorative Air Force, they've come out with their 12 Planes of Christmas to support World War II aircraft restoration. David, you want to tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, absolutely. The Confederate Air Force actually did
commemorative.
This
commemorative. I know.
Did I say it again?
Yeah, they used to be for those of you listening, they used to be the Confederate Air Force, and they changed. It's been quite a while, but I do the same thing, David. I very frequently call it the Confederate Air Force when it's more properly the Commemorative Air Force.
The CAF.
There you go.
Actually started this last year, and they picked 12 aircraft in their fleet that need money for restoration. So you can make a tax-free donation to one of 12 aircraft in one of the units for various – one of them is a TBF, one of them is a B-25, one of them is a Texan, and a BT-13. So if you go to the link in the show notes, you'll see the list of aircraft, and you can – make a donation, and that money will actually go to that specific aircraft. So you're not donating to the organization itself, but actually you're making a donation towards the restoration of an aircraft.
I think that's pretty cool. And, you know, as we approach the end of the year, if you live in a country that allows you to deduct charitable contributions, many of us are looking for organizations to donate to. This month. And I always try to find aviation-related charitable organizations, things like that. So if that's what you're interested in doing, this would be a great one for you to consider this year. Well, let's move on to a little bit of listener mail. First from John. He sent us a link to a YouTube video, Shark US Vlog 1, Cheeseburgers and Milkshakes at the Robin's Nest. And this is a short video about flying the Shark US to the Robin's Nest Cafe at the Shannon Airport in Fredericksburg, Virginia, KEZF. This was for the infamous, quote, $100 hamburger. You can find that video in the show notes. This Shark is a pretty slick-looking airplane. Max Trescott, this is a light sport aircraft. I think it's in that category, isn't it?
Sure. The light sport would be typically a two-place aircraft, fly less than 100 to 20 miles an hour. This one, since it can go up to 206, might not be light sport.
It's definitely – I think they named it appropriately. I think just the lines of it are kind of shark-like.
You know, it's kind of interesting, too, the way they have the air outlets there right on the side of the front. It almost looks like the gills of a shark on the, up on the nose of the aircraft. That's pretty bizarre.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah, when I look at this, I keep thinking of Sharknado, and this is just such a more beautiful thing to look at than that film. But anyway.
All right. We also heard from Ryan Hothersall. He says, let's see, he sent us a link to some photos, the RV4, he says, VH, NOJ, that John Johansson flew around the world is now preserved at the South Australian Aviation Museum. So he's got some photos there, some Flickr photos. Put a link to that in the show notes. Also, we'd been talking about air tractors last time. He's got a bunch of photos. He says, here they are in action as water bombers during a bad brush fire north of Adelaide, South Australia in November 2015. And he says the scene at Gawler Airfield reminded me, he says, what an airfield during the Battle of Britain may have looked like. A lot of aircraft there. Just a bunch of photos. They're quite nice. A lot of air tractor. If you're an air tractor fan, for sure, you'll want to take a look at these. All right. So I think that is about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Captain Nick Anderson. Nick, again, delight to have you on the show. We really appreciate it.
Always an absolute pleasure to be on board. And thank you very much indeed for including me. And good luck with the rest of your podcast. You are probably one of the oldest aviation podcasts around, aren't you? You've got an awful lot of shows under your belt.
Yeah, one of them started in 2008.
That's pretty good going. And I know Captain Jeff attributes his success to the fact that you had him on in his early days. And I know his audience numbers leapt as a result. So we owe you a great debt.
Oh, that's very kind. Do you think you will ever create a spin-off podcast of your own?
Well, I've only got 2 and a bit years until I retire, and I don't know if Captain Jeff wants a retired pilot on his show, so I may move perhaps over to let some current youngster take my place and just either keep him going with Plane Tales, or perhaps I might take that history podcast on and see what I can do with it.
That'd be wonderful. We would definitely all look forward to that. So,
and Captain Nick, are you planning on coming over to the U.S. for the meetup in Pittsburgh?
Well, I am. Unfortunately, I can't book leave for it. It's I've already put bids in for that period, so it'll depend upon my days off. And if I've got days off, you can be sure I'll jump a jet and come over and see you guys. That would be great.
Very good. We haven't promoted that much yet. We'll be talking about that shortly, I think. We have an opportunity to have kind of a large meetup at an air show coming up next year, 2017, in Pittsburgh. But we'll talk more about that in the future. For now, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode, if you want to go straight to the show notes, that's at airplanegeeks.com/430. Of course, our homepage has links to where you can contact us via email, where you can find us on social media. There's also a donate button if you'd like to help support the show financially. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Max Trescott, we'll start with you.
Well, anybody who wants to come fly a Diamond Twin Star that left the factory 1 week ago can look for my SJ, short for San Jose, sjflight.com, my website, and contact me about flying in that plane. Or you can find my books at g1000book.com.
Great. And Brian Coleman, how do folks find you?
Best place to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com. And if anyone wants to go back and listen to the archives, they are at airplanegeeks.com/archives.
And David Vanderhoof.
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. And, of course, you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof and on Friday mornings with that guy Max Flight talking about drones on the UAVDigest.com.
All right. And we'll mention for Rob Marks or on Rob Marks' behalf, you can find him either in print or online at Flying Magazine, also at jetwine.com. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David mentioned, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at the PAXX podcast with Mary Kirby. That's PAXEX podcast.com. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. And our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. That's M-I-S-O-N-N-E. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
All the best.
And thanks for listening.
Did you have something, Brian, or are we?
Yeah, at the very beginning of, well, at the very end of the intro for Captain Nick, you actually called him Captain Jeff. So
what?
You
no.
might want to go. Yeah, you did. So you might want to go back and fix that at some
all right.
point.
All right.
Sorry. Just, I noticed it.
Okay.
Well, ask Nick. Does he care? He wants to be Captain Jeff.
I have a feeling the reference was to joining a podcast with Captain Jeff. I don't think you actually called me Captain Jeff, but then again, I wasn't listening.
Yeah.
You weren't paying any attention anyway.
I'd heard it before.